Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. Today, our guests are Popular Mechanics Editor-in-Chief Jim Miggs, who's going to talk about their long-term test of hybrid versus gas cars and whether the hybrids live up to the hype or not.
We also have Michael Gorion, the founder of the Gorion Institute.
For years, people have been worrying about girls falling behind in schools. Now they're forging ahead, and people are noticing that it's the boys who are being left behind. Michael Gorion has been writing about this for years, and we've got him on the phone now.
So, Mr. Gorion, what are teachers missing about boys? What do teachers in public schools need to know about them that they don't know right now?
Well, first of all, there's the basic training in how boys learn. So, in other words, how the male brain and the female brain are set up differently, the structural differences, the functional differences, so that boys and girls learn differently. That basic knowledge most teachers don't have because the universities don't teach it. So our Gorion Institute program is, in a sense, it's a substitute for what we would hope ultimately all the universities would teach the young teachers. So that's in a general sense. Then in a specific sense, once the teachers learn that, they actually innovate because they're very smart, obviously. They innovate. They just needed that piece that the male brain is different than the female. And so boys, you know, will learn with less words, more kinesthetic, more spatial mechanical, more visual. These sorts of things, the teachers will then innovate. And boys and girls learn differently. We just tested it out. We taught six school districts and the brain differences and in Missouri, and then they came up with about 200 innovations that they could use. And then in The Minds of Boys, which is, of course, the newest book, very similar. We taught a number of innovations, but they came up with a bunch. And one of the great ones that the teachers came up with was to let the boys draw before they write. These are the third, fourth, fifth grade boys. Let them draw panels, visuals, graphics before they write. Well, they get a lot more sensory detail in the writing once they draw. That's, you know, obviously just one example.
Right. Well, why do you think there's so many schools that have no idea, and what they do is they tend to, you know, over-medicate boys or just tell boys to sit down, or they don't really understand some of these, you know, differences in boys and girls? Why do you think some teachers are reluctant to learn that? Because sometimes when you bring it up to them, I'm a, you know, forensic psychologist and a school and clinical psychologist, and sometimes teachers, I think, maybe they're overwhelmed or they're reluctant to learn some of these things that they need to increase the, you know, awareness about boys in the classroom.
Well, the cultural trends, as you know, the trends have been for the last 30 to 40 years, the trends have been to try to bring parity to girls, which really is culturally and for the civilization was the right move, because education, I mean, if we had to focus on one thing, which is unfortunate, but since we did have to, it appears, in terms of gender, that was the right thing to focus on, because girls, until, you know, in the last few decades, there were a number of girls who weren't able to fit. So I think that the whole cultural movement toward understanding girls was important. What happened, unfortunately, was that the academic feminist frame, that whole frame, which is that boys are privileged, boys succeed, girls are victims, girls don't succeed, that frame took over schools of education, and it took over the gender dialogue in education. And that frame was actually not a correct frame. It was a good rhetorical frame. It was a good way to push the political agenda, but it was not accurate. There were millions of boys who were not privileged and who were not succeeding and who didn't. And in 1978, already, girls, as they were gaining parity, already more girls by 1978 were going to college than boys. That was 78. So, so I think the frame it needs to be changed, and obviously I've devoted a great deal of my life to that. If we change the frame that the schools of ed use, then the teachers come out of the schools of ed or go into the schools of ed saying, oh, I really want to help these boys and these girls.
But how do we change the frame?
And now I have the tools.
How do we change the frame when so many people are reluctant? For example, when I bring up anything about boys, a lot of times there's a backlash against me, and people will say, well, you don't care about girls, and they don't understand. Yeah, I cared about girls when girls needed the help, but at this point, boys do, and a lot of people... men and women included, there's a backlash, and people get very hostile towards the idea of helping boys.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, something's happened. Since The Minds of Boys, this newest book of mine, came out now this year, and then 10 years ago, The Wonder of Boys. I published The Wonder of Boys that kind of clicked a lot of this. And I'll tell you, there's a big difference in 10 years. Mm-hmm. When I put out The Wonder of Boys, I just got constant backlash. But now with The Minds of Boys, I hardly get any, because now 10 years later, mainly moms and female teachers, you know, are jumping on board. The dads and the men sort of always knew, because they went through a lot of this. They went through the industrial schooling system, and they knew that it worked for some and it didn't work for a lot. But now the moms who have sons and the teachers who are teaching boys and seeing these boys fail and be put on Ritalin and so on, they're rising up. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, hey, we're going to change the frame. And we know it's happening, because our work's now based on 10 years of action research from the Institute. And, you know, we've trained 15,000 teachers, gone into hundreds of schools, and we're getting almost no backlash. So I think actually a lot is changing.
That's big.
In the last 10 years.
Uh-huh. And what can a typical parent, for example, someone like myself or somebody else, I don't have a son, I have a daughter, but my daughter has kind of a rebellious streak. I mean, what can we kind of do in our public schools? What are some things that we can do if we have a boy that needs help in the public schools? How can we help these teachers to help our sons?
Well, and that's the big question. And so there are, of course, hundreds of things to do. I'll try to break quickly into a few categories. The first category is get everyone trained, especially the K-6 teachers who are 90% female. Show them the PET scans and the SPECT scans and get them trained and show them how different male and female brain are, and then they will do a lot. They will take care of a lot of the problem. Number two, we need to get parents to understand the developmental needs of boys specifically. So I'll do really quickly. For instance, if there's a 5-year-old boy who's not reading the way that someone told the parent the boy should read, once the parent learns this stuff about the minds of boys, the parent will back off and will say, oh, wait a minute, my boy's naturally wired not to develop those verbals until probably a year from now. I'm just not going to, you know, do this anymore. I'm not going to buy into this whole thing he's got to read today. I'm going to be patient. You know, so there's all these changes that will happen in the home. One of the biggest changes that, and our first chapter's on it, is creating that parent-led educational team, where we have 5 people devoted to helping this boy, and this works for girls too, I have 2 daughters, helping this boy to go through school. And it's the mom, the dad, the grandpa, the grandma, the aunt, the uncle, the neighbor, the kid's best friend's father, you know, and so on. This team needs to anthropologically move the boy through a very difficult school system. These are big tectonic shift type things that people can do. And the parent-led team, I'll tell you, becomes very popular. Parent co-ops, people love getting together to get these people together. And what they often find is they have to make sure to have 1 or 2 men, especially in this team, especially as the boy hits 8, 9, or 10, make sure to have 1 or 2 men in that 5-person team.
So it could be
team.
A family member. For example, I have a lot of boys that I work with, and they don't have a team. They don't have anybody. They don't
right.
have a father. Half the time, mom's not available. And those boys are the ones that I really see falling through the cracks. And I know you've written about this, you know, in your Washington Post article, but they're the boys who really fall through the cracks. And, you know, where do you come up with a team for a boy that doesn't have anyone?
You have to come up with a team. Everyone can come up with a team. Once they buy into it and they realize that this problem cannot be solved by one parent and it cannot be solved by one teacher, that's not human nature. Human nature needs various stimulants. The growing brain needs various emotional and psychological and mental stimulants. So that boy who has no father, who is getting in trouble with the law, who is, you know, who hates school or says school sucks, or, you know, just doesn't have any value in school, we have to do everything we can to get that boy a mentor and to get him connected to, and through that mentor to get him connected through some sort of team, whether it's athletic or, you know, whatever it is. Because if not, he'll go into a gang searching for the team. It's natural for him to go through the life process and the search for meaning and purpose with this team. So we give it to him, or the gang gives it to him. And there is no, I've worked with so many and who start out saying, I can't find it. There is no person who can't find it. They have to go to churches. They have to go to Big Brothers. They have to go to Boy Scouts. They have to go to the school athletic teams. They simply have to devote themselves for about 3 to 4 months to forming this team. Now, if the boy's 17 or 18, he's already ensconced in a gang. You know, I mean, my book, The Minds of Boys, will not help with that. That's illegal. That's going to become a legal matter, and he's going to be moving through the criminal
justice
system.
Do you think the shortage of male teachers, especially at the elementary school level, is part of the problem?
The primary, see, we've got, again, this 10 years of research, and what we see is the primary problem is the female teachers don't understand the boys. Once they do, they generally fix the problem. And at the same time, it would be great to have male teachers because there's a male instinct. But I sort of operate out of the reality that we're probably not going to increase K-6 more than 10% male. So we don't want to operate out of the reality that, well, if we just separate all the boys and give them all male teachers, it'll solve the problem, because that's not real. That's
so
not
you don't really
happen.
Believe in same-sex classrooms, then?
Pardon me?
You don't really believe in, like, a same-sex classroom?
Oh, yeah, I love same-sex classrooms. We do a lot of training of separate-sex and same-sex, and we call it single-gender classrooms, especially for core. I think that's great, and especially in middle school. It's not an either-or, but the thing is, the reality is, the culture is never going to go straight separate-sex. That's not going to happen. We're going to have wonderful, and if people go to GurionInstitute.com or they look in the minds of boys, they'll see a bunch of schools, beautiful, wonderful schools we helped with separate-sex classrooms. But even those schools know that the culture is not going to go completely separate-sex. So we have to train the female teachers who are going to be teaching boys in co-ed also, and our research shows that that takes care of most of the problem.
Okay, so I should get the mind of boys for all the teachers at my kid's school, is that right?
Well, if they want to understand the boys, and the right. thing is, it's very teacher-friendly. You know, there's no, we don't attack anyone. We think that the industrial schooling system has really let teachers down and not provided them with this training. And we know from 10 years of action research that once they get the training, they become the solvers of the problem. So our message is really simple. Once teachers understand and parents understand the minds of boys, they will solve the problem. And it doesn't have to be an expert telling them what to do.
Mm-hmm. Can you define the industrial classroom for people?
Yeah, the industrial classroom is this, as one can imagine, it grows from Industrial Revolution, and we ended up with needing to educate so many young people, both males and females, to compete in workplaces and just to work, that we created a classroom of 30 to 40 kids, one teacher, because for population, that's all we could do, one teacher, 30 to 40 kids. We need to rely on textbooks. They need to read a lot. They can't learn kinesthetically. We need to cut out recess. We need to test more, you know, so they have to sit even more for testing. They need to be reading as early as possible. Well, a lot of this stuff is not a fit for the male brain. Male brain gets its reading and writing skills about a year and a half later than female. Male brain is a much more spatial, mechanical brain, a kinesthetic brain, needs to touch things in order to learn, doesn't retain as many words. That classroom is not as good a fit for probably 30 to 40% of the males, but it is a good fit for probably 80 to 90% of the females. And so that's that industrial classroom.
So what do you do if you're a girl, say, that's got that very kinesthetic sense of learning? I know that's how I was when I was a girl, and it was very difficult for me to fit into a normal classroom.
Yeah, one of my daughters is that way. And it's very important to say to people, and I'm also the author of The Wonder of Girls. So I'm a girls advocate. None of this is either or anymore. You know, none of us are involved in zero sum or any of that. Every innovation that we've come up with through the boys' research is helpful to girls who fit that brain frame. And like I say, one of my own daughters, I'm very conscious in helping her that she's a kinesthetic and spatial mechanical learner and not as much of a verbal learner. So I bring a lot of these principles to her. It can work with both. It's ultimately about seeing what the nature of this child is. And just statistically, the industrial classroom fits the nature of females better. But there are many exceptions on both sides to this.
Right. What about video watching? I know, but video games. I know that you talk about the content is not that important. In other words, it's okay for boys to play video games and to have some aggression in their lives.
Oh, yeah. Aggression is human. The key is aggression versus violence. Where does aggression become violent? Aggression is what built everything, and aggression is what created a civilization. But violence is learned. So aggression is natural. Violence is learned. For me, the definition I use that you'll find here is that aggression is one organism or system attempting to exploit, manipulate, or control another organism or system. That's human nature. Both males and females do it. Males have more testosterone. They tend to do it more physically, but everyone does it. We all try to exploit and control each other. But violence is one system or one organism trying to destroy the core nature of another organism or system. So going in and enslaving whole populations and slaughtering people, obviously biggest form of violence, and then in video games, we do definitely see violence. We see people trying to destroy the core nature of other people. But also in video games, what we see is heroes, you know, who are fighting these bad guys. Well, if a child gets, you know, a half hour or 45 minutes of this sort of aggression stimulation in a day of the good guy fighting the bad guy and all of that, I find no research that says that's harmful. It will increase his impulsiveness shortly after playing the game, but that's not in itself making him violent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people need to understand that males are going to gravitate toward what I've called aggression nurturance. They're trying to nurture in themselves and in each other this heroic impulse, and they'll gravitate toward these aggression-oriented games and stories. And, you know, I played Cowboys and Indians when I was a kid, or G.I. Joe. Every generation will have these. So, but however, what's crucial here also is if they're playing 2 to 3 hours of these, then not only are they spending simply too much time with violence, but it's actually going to invade their neural development, because now we have 2 to 3 hours of this passive stimulant, and the boy's not talking to anyone, you know, he's not relating emotionally, he's not processing emotions in that 3 hours, because all he's doing is playing the game. That then becomes dangerous to his development. So the key things are, yes, aggression's okay, but we need to do this in moderation.
Right, so about 30 minutes a day, maybe to an hour, is okay.
Yeah, and after homework's done, mm-hmm. or he's performing well in school, he's performing well as a human being. Video games are a privilege, they're not a need. So, you know, we can take away Game Boys at any moment as a parent, and we need to make sure to do that because we're in control.
But we also need to be teaching, as you say, moral and, you know, moral development and character in boys. And I think that's one of the things that's lacking that I've seen. I mean, people seem to have a hard time teaching what is right and what is wrong to kids, and because nobody wants to judge children anymore. How do you think that plays itself out in, say, violence?
Oh yeah. Character. I think that character development, truthfully, I think what we should be teaching to boys, well, to all children, of course, but specifically we're talking about boys, is character development. And we need to put emotional development under character development. And why do I say that? Because for the last 30 years or so, we've moved much more toward a frame for raising boys that says, look, if boys cry, if they talk about their feelings, then that's going to solve the problems of violence. There's no proof for that. And in fact, if we look at Japan, that's a very nonviolent culture, and those boys don't talk about their feelings, and they play very violent video games constantly, and they're not violent people. So but we've used this formula for 30 years. We'll solve all the problems of boys if they just cry and talk about their feelings. And of course, you know, I have a different frame. My frame is that crying and talking about feelings is a good thing. I'm a therapist. It's a good thing. But it needs to come underneath the larger frame of character, moral, and spiritual development, because it's the larger frame that will give boys purpose, give them meaning, give them a mission in life. And if a 17-year-old can cry and talk about his feelings, but he has no mission in life, then he's going to destroy the world. So I would like to see the larger frame focused on.
I deal with all those boys.
And you're seeing them destroy the world.
Yes, I deal with the ones who are in some very serious trouble.
Right.
Well, our time is about up here. I wish we could go on and on, but I think if people get the book, The Minds of Boys, they can continue the conversation, and it makes me really want to get the book for the teachers in my kids' classroom. So we really appreciate it, and we greatly appreciate all the work you're doing for boys, and I know there are a lot of men and boys out there that appreciate your work.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty, bye-bye.
Bye, thanks.
With gas prices going higher, there's been a lot of interest in hybrid cars, and there are a lot of new hybrid models out on the market. But lately, there's been a backlash, with articles in the Wall Street Journal and the Weekly Standard suggesting that hybrids are a fraud and don't really deliver on their promises. We've got one, and we actually like it a lot. We have a Toyota Highlander hybrid.
It's a great car, and the great thing about it is it drives like a small car, but you've got a big sport U with great gas mileage.
That's just our experience, but for a more scientific look, we have on the phone Jim Miggs, the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics. They've been evaluating hybrid cars and even testing them wheel-to-wheel with their gasoline equivalents to decide whether they're worth the money and the trouble and what they bode for the future.
We were interested in the whole hybrid question, A, just because our readers are fascinated with any advance in automotive technology, but also we saw that there was this kind of hybrid backlash going on. There was a lot of skepticism coming out about hybrids from various sources when people really sat down to do the math and they saw that in a lot of cases, you're not going to be making that money back anytime soon in your fuel savings, your extra investment in a hybrid. And then from a lot of environmentalists, there was some dismay that some of the big car makers are beginning to put hybrid technology into bigger, heavier vehicles. So it's not just the Prius. You know, obviously, the Toyota Highlander is one of the hottest vehicles out there, and that is not the kind of vehicle that makes the Sierra Club jump for joy. Even worse from their point of view is GM's announcement that they're going to start putting hybrid technology into a bunch of big, heavy pickup trucks. So,
why are the environmentalists so against the heavier cars?
Well, I think the Sierra Club's view would be, why are you claiming, some kind of environmental virtue when all you've done is taken a pickup truck from, 16 miles to the gallon to 19 miles to the gallon or something like that? They would rather everybody be driving Priuses. And certainly, if that were true, our fuel consumption would be drastically lower. But we were interested in really getting some hard numbers to add to this debate, because there's so much kind of, there's a lot of heat and not much light in this. So we took two of the most, of two popular hybrids that have a gasoline-powered, more or less equivalent version. So we took the Honda Civic EX, the gasoline-powered Civic, and matched that up against the Honda Civic Hybrid. And then we took the Toyota Highlander Limited and matched up against the Highlander Hybrid Limited. So, and put them through the exact same battery of tests. And what we found, which I thought was really interesting, was that on the Civic side, the Civic is already a really high mileage efficient car. I mean, we were getting 33 miles to the gallon in the city with the non-hybrid Civic. That goes up to 39.6 for the hybrid. So you get a nice bump, but it's already a very efficient car. What really surprised us a little bit was on the hybrid Highlander, because this car had come in for a lot of criticism in the New York Times and other places. What we found there, we got 17.4 in the city on the gasoline-powered version, and we got 31.6 mpg city on the hybrid version. So that's almost twice the mileage in the city where the hybrid technology really has an advantage, as you know, because you have a Highlander.
Yeah, we have a Highlander hybrid, and we love it.
Right. Hybrid technology doesn't do much once you get the car up and running on the highway. It's really stop-and-go traffic. And if you stop to think about it, a heavier vehicle, the Highlander is about 4,000 pounds, a heavier vehicle is actually in some ways going to see more benefit from the hybrid technology, precisely because it takes more energy just to get that thing up and rolling. And then you're storing more energy, so when you slow down and you're using that regenerative braking, you've got a lot more energy to pump back into those batteries. So we sort of feel like what we discovered is that the criticism from the environmental side is a little misplaced. Unless they're going to pass a law and force everybody to drive a Prius, if people who are interested, who need the room, or they need the four-wheel drive, or they feel they need the size of a bigger vehicle, if a significant portion of these people were to shift over to hybrid technology, even though the mileage they're getting isn't going to make anybody swoon, it actually will save a lot more fuel than if we got everybody who currently already drives a high mileage car to switch to a hybrid. So it's a little bit counterintuitive from the environmental point of view, but in fact, we think there's a real opportunity here.
So if it's about saving gas rather than about demonstrating moral purity, you think that the hybrid SUVs and pickup trucks may actually make a big difference?
I think they do make a big difference. Now, one criticism is, well, why should these vehicles get, special tax breaks? Why should people get to drive in the high occupancy vehicle lanes? I mean, ultimately, Ferrari could come out with a hybrid and you could be getting 12 miles
nice.
Per gallon. And I think there's a legitimate question whether the government should be in the business of kind of putting its chips on a particular technology rather than trying to encourage a particular outcome and letting the industry work out a variety of technological solutions to it. But in terms of the impact on our nation's energy consumption, I think hybrids, if anything, are a little bit underrated right now by some of the critics, some of the people that really ought to be supporting any kind of innovation we can find.
Right, because, everybody in our neighborhood has a big sport ute, and if everybody here would just switch over to the hybrids, originally we weren't going to, we didn't get a sport ute because of the gas mileage, but then when we saw the great gas mileage we were getting with the hybrid, we went ahead and, and bought that. But, you know, just if everybody would switch over, it seems like it would really help out.
I think it would. The other thing I think that people are criticizing is that some of the hybrid technologies are being used for performance, and, you know, whether quicker acceleration or in the case of the Highlander also electric four-wheel drive system it has. And I think that there's some frustration there that the hybrid system isn't being necessarily tweaked for maximum mileage, but to achieve other goals that are meaningful to the driver. And again, I think there's a sense that only, if we could only convince people that the only thing they should care about is mileage, this, the world would be a better place. But I think if you can come up with, I love that electric all-wheel, technically really it should be called all-wheel drive system, because if you look at a typical sport utility, there's an enormous amount of weight and mechanical complexity devoted to the four-wheel drive system that isn't used very often. You know, if you can just stick a little electric motor back there instead, you still have weight because you have the batteries, but you have, in many ways, a much simpler system. And I think that we'll see this becoming increasingly popular for people who, you know, it's not designed for hardcore four-wheeling, but for the kind of snowy roads and occasional mud patch that most people use four-wheel drive for.
You actually found,
smart advance.
You actually found, didn't you, that the hybrid Highlander handled better than the gas equivalent, too.
Yeah, that was a surprise to us, and I think that is a couple of our testers are very oriented towards performance cars. I mean, one of them basically said, you know, why not pay a little more for a car that delivers better performance, better acceleration? This is something that is, I think, sometimes undervalued by hybrid critics, but I think it's the kind of attention to consumer needs or consumer desires that might help hybrids gain in popularity despite the price boost.
Yeah, I get the sense Toyota cared about that a lot with our car. In fact, I sort of wish that it had a switch that would let me put it in super economy mode, because it'll do things like idle the engine to get the heater going, or it's obviously they've decided they want it to be as pleasant a driving experience as possible. And they're not making all the sacrifices. Now, I'm not sure I want to go as far as the Sierra Club and say that each, you know, new vehicle should come with a complimentary hair shirt. But I'd sort of like to have a switch, because I find that I try to drive for mileage. And my experience, I mean, I traded in a Passat station wagon, which did pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I would get around 24 miles per gallon in town on that, and about 30, 31 on the highway. With the Highlander, I'm getting mid-30s in town, and on my drive to work, which is like the perfect hybrid route, I get about 38.
Wow.
And the highway mileage, not as good. That's about 24 or 25, but I don't drive on the highway nearly as much as I drive in town. And I'd actually like a switch that would let me sort of optimize my mileage and adjust when the gas motor kicked in and such, for a little more economy-oriented approach.
And that would be pretty easy for them to do. There's a real sort of debate, I think, in the auto business as to how transparent the technology should be, or how visible it should be, and how much control consumers should be given over it. One thing that the readout you have that tells you what mode you're in as you're driving around, a lot of drivers tell us that has a big influence on how they drive.
Oh, yeah.
Much more conscious. And it's kind of a game then to tweak it. And, you know, honestly, even if everybody in the country just had a little, you know, a little mileage red light that would go off every time they're wasting gas through their driving habits, I think people would be a lot more efficient right there. But you spent the money on the hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
You're interested in how the technology works, so you want to make the most of it. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we see the ability to customize the system to user desire that way down the road. It would make a lot of sense. And the kind of person who buys a hybrid tends to be someone who is interested in the technology and likes to be aware of exactly what's going on. And it's actually fairly complicated. The algorithms, the car's computer uses to determine when to switch over, when to engage the electric motor, and there's a lot going on in there. So it's kind of fun to understand it, I think.
I think that's right. So last question. The hybrid's pretty clearly a transitional technology. What do you think will come later on?
Well, you know, the big automakers have been talking about two things, hydrogen and various forms of biofuels. We're a little bit skeptical on both fronts. And I advocating a diversity of approaches, because who knows where the biggest real efficiencies will come. But right now, we're not convinced that biofuels are remotely close to making economic or environmental sense. And so the real efficiency of those vehicles will mostly be political. If the government wants to subsidize the price of ethanol, which they're doing already, as a big favor to American farmers, then, you know, that may bring the price of that fuel down, but it won't be because it's naturally a lot cheaper than drilling for oil. It may be an advantage for other reasons, political reasons or strategic reasons. On the hydrogen, there's just a big gap between the cost of hydrogen today and the amount of energy that goes into creating it and the cost of gasoline. So, you know, I think it'll come at some time, but we're not expecting it anywhere near as soon as some of the automakers imply. You know, we've got a long way to go before we're going to see a huge run-up in gasoline prices before that fuel becomes really practical in day-to-day driving.
Well, I guess one thing the hybrids have done is shown the car makers that there really is a market for cars that get good mileage.
Yeah, and well, you know, people during the current gas spike, there's a lot of criticism of the car makers. Why didn't they make the cars that people, the high mileage cars? They'd be doing much better today. And people kind of forget that they were making high mileage cars, but people weren't buying them. And when prices were low, people invested really heavily in very heavy vehicles. So, you know, the consumer does have a role in this, and you can't blame everything on, you know, why did you sell me this car I don't want anymore? But it is interesting, and I think it's gratifying to see that people, a wide range of people, are really interested in hybrids. And what we found in interviewing owners is they don't really mind, in a lot of cases, that they paid a premium for what they see as better technology. Mm-hmm. They're not as interested just in saving money from day one as they are in driving a car to them that represents superior technology and really the future of where the automotive world ought to be going. I think that's something the automakers should take seriously.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, this was kind of an all-guy stuff episode. We had manly sport utes, and then a look at boys in education.
Well, I think it's something that women would be interested in, too. After all, we do drive, and we have sons and husbands that we want to look after.
That's absolutely right. Well, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we hope you will tune in for future episodes. You can see them by checking our websites at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. Or you can subscribe to our RSS feed or get it via iTunes or a whole bunch of other podcatching software operations. In the meantime, well, we'll see you next time.
Talk to you soon.